Hi, it's Diane. On my mind has been taking a break this summer. While we were away, we left you with a special series, some favorite interviews with musicians from the Diane Rehm Show archive. Today is our last installment before we return with new episodes. It's a conversation with legendary singer, actor, and civil rights activist Harry Belafonte. He joined me in December 2003. For joining us, I'm Diane Rehm. Yesterday, Harry Belafonte spoke at the National Press Club. His speech touched on the war in Iraq, the AIDS-HIV pandemic, Haitian asylum seekers, and repayment of international debt. Although it's not unusual for entertainers to support charitable causes, few have done so with the success and dedication of Harry Belafonte. For over 50 years, he's combined a love of the arts with a love of humanity. His work in both areas has been recognized the world over. Harry Belafonte joins me in the studio to talk about past achievements, current events, and future projects. What a pleasure to see you, sir.
Well, Diane, let me tell you that I'm very excited to be on the air with you once again.
Thank you.
To see you looking so well.
Oh, thank you, and you as well. Talk about what brings you to Washington and the topics about which you spoke yesterday at the National Press Club.
I serve on the board of a truly remarkable organization here in Washington called TransAfrica, and it was created in 1977 as an organization that would monitor American policy as it relates to Africa and parts of the world that make up the African diaspora. And we've had a long journey as an organization. We spearheaded the anti-apartheid movement in America and did much to focus America's attention on the issues of apartheid in South Africa and ultimately the release of Nelson Mandela. We've been also speaking out on policies and issues that affect the Caribbean region, in particular Haiti, but we also talk to other regions as well. And in TransAfrica, we have a connected aspect to the organization called the TransAfrica Forum, which is an educational arm of TransAfrica, which is a lobbying organization. And in TransAfrica Forum, we have a division called the Arthur Ashe Foreign Policy Library. And Arthur Ashe, at the height of his great popularity as a great athlete and tennis player, and as a great American, had believed somewhat in an oversimplified way that if he could just go to South Africa and play tennis before an integrated audience and desegregate the tennis courts of South Africa, that perhaps there would be a new dawning on the whole horizon for the whole issue of apartheid. And he went there in the face of the sanctions and the boycott, and a lot of people were concerned that he had violated those sanctions. However, when Arthur went and had the direct experience that he had in South Africa, he not only understood that his position was rather naive, even if it were gently so, and he became quite active and deeply committed to lending himself in political and social support for the cause of the sanctions against South Africa and the anti-apartheid movement. He created within our organization a thing called Artists and Athletes Against Apartheid. And out of that, and his commitment to us and being on the board for the forum, he created the Arthur Ashe Foreign Policy Library, which was for the purpose of trying to attract enough books and memorabilia that not only told us about Africa from traditional sources of material, but to try to find unusual material that gave another point of view on what Africa is, what the history of the continent has been, and where it's going, and what are the real voices of the current leaders and current policies, and also to monitor very carefully what the United States does in its relationship to that continent. Our event tomorrow is being held at the True Reformer Building at 1200 U Street, Northwest Washington. And in that building, people will be gathering. They'll get a chance to see some of the books on display and talk to many of us about Arthur Ashe, about Africa, about what we do, and about our nation at large.
And, of course, you have been not only outspoken about Africa, but you've been quite vocal in your opposition to the war in Iraq.
Well, you know, it was Theodore Roosevelt who once said, and I paraphrase here, the essence of his statement was that when the state begins to unfold a villainy that will undermine the constitution of this nation and begin to deny citizens that which is rightfully theirs by the law, it is incumbent upon citizens to not only take note of this characteristic, but to also exert their right to dissent and to be vocal against such intervention. And I think that what's going on with the current administration has been in huge violation of much that our Constitution protects.
How so?
Well, for instance, in the laws that are coming about now on home security, the way in which Ashcroft has piloted these new laws, which under the guise of the security of this country has now said that the justice system has the right to arrest citizens without charge, to hold them in incarceration for as long as they deem necessary, without the benefit of counsel. That kind of behavior is just completely against the Constitution of this country and what our nation stands for.
Now, one can argue, cannot one, that perhaps this country has not been attacked again because of some of those ground rules that the Attorney General and this administration have put into place. I am playing devil's advocate.
There was a very dark period in America's history during the Second World War. And I served in that war in the United States Navy as a munitions loader and was very, very much in tune with what was affecting our planet and our societies. That dark moment in our history was not just Pearl Harbor, but there was a time when we responded by setting up internment camps and moving Japanese citizens against the laws of our Constitution into a place where they were contained as citizens who we considered to be a threat to the interest and the security of this nation. Now, nothing could have been further from the truth, and that it was something that we should not have done. So I'm mindful of that fact. Let me hasten to say that during the Second World War, the Germans, which had a very sophisticated fifth column system, had a very sophisticated secret police and was around the world undermining and ensuring the weakening of many countries before it invaded them through spy policies and through the power of using its influence to buy off governments and leaders. Here in the United States of America, there was not one act of sabotage that took place in our nation. We were that secure at the height of one of the greatest wars we've ever known. In the Cold War with the Soviet Union, when we were threatened by the KGB and we said that nuclear war was always in our horizon, there was not one act of sabotage in this country that affected the American people because our system was very much intact to protect us against that. In the war in Vietnam, which was one of the great tragedies of our policy and an experience that this nation had just very recently, there was no act of sabotage or anything that harmed this nation during the many years of that confrontation. So there is no history that suggests that the our laws as they stand is not enough to protect the citizens of this country. So to honor the guise of the protection of our citizens, to now suspend these laws and to put something in its place that violates the rights of citizens and have begun to intimidate citizens of this country, surveillance by neighbors, which are some of the instructions we're given, watch very carefully for unusual behavior with your neighbors. Well, you know, I got to tell you, without that instruction, I watch out for peculiar behavior from my neighbors anyway. And not because I think they're going to blow up my house. You know, I think that's just part of the game.
I understand that. All of that, of course, the wonderful background in history you've given us was prior to September 11, 2001, which apparently changed the minds of many people. As you well know, this country is very divided in its thinking about how we protect ourselves and to what extent we should go.
Diane, let me hasten to just say to you that the events of 9/11 did not come about because the laws in the United States were not strong. The laws of the United States were not well-placed. The citizens in this country were not well-protected by the laws that exist. It wasn't a matter of law. It was a matter of executing the responsibility that our intelligence community was given, the kinds of warnings that they had detected that were passed on to higher authority that chose to disregard those warnings and therefore put policy in place that some wanted to put in place because they had another agenda and used 9/11 as the excuse by which to unfold an agenda that had absolutely nothing to do with terrorism. So to now say to us that we must change laws or suspend laws because our security is in jeopardy is to mislead the American people, because it was not because of the absence of the proper laws or the laws that protect us that caused 9/11.
Here is a first email who says, I wish to complain about how unfair Mr. Belafonte is. He and I are about the same age, and back in my youth, the girls I was dating were all in love with him. Could he at least apologize now?
Let me hasten to not only apologize, but to say that none of that was ever my intention. I'm sorry for any inconvenience you may have been caused, and just tell me in what way may I make it up to you.
And now here's a question on a more serious level. Seeing that the Voting Rights Act is not a permanent law and is due for renewal or extension in a few years, do you plan to use your position to advocate permanent status?
Absolutely. I have already met with members of the Black Caucus just recently on Capitol Hill for the purpose of looking over a host of legislative issues that deeply affect the interests of African-American citizens and other citizens of color. And certainly we are all very much aware of the fact that the Voting Rights Act has to be revisited, and that I would hope that when we do the next time, that legislation would be in place to make it a permanent part of the process.
Last October, Mr. Belafonte, you made some comments about Colin Powell that caused quite an uproar. Tell us about those comments and what you heard in return.
Well, I was doing a radio interview, and I was kind of caught off guard because I was told that the interview would just be about music and art and culture. And in the middle of this, the interviewer asked me what did I think of Colin Powell and the work he was doing. And I had not been quite ready for that, and I had to make a shift mentally to understand the ramifications of what was involved in the question and how to answer it. And I said just very simply that with all else that was going on, I thought that Colin Powell served his master well. The interviewer took great exception to the fact that I said master, and I wanted to know what did I mean by that. And then I said, well, let me give you the metaphor. In the days of slavery, there were those who lived on the plantation and those who lived in the master's house. Those who lived in the master's house had many options of things they could do. Either serve the master faithfully and never disturb the status quo, or those who found favor in the master's house to begin to put before the master ideas and thoughts that might help relieve the burden that others felt working out on the plantation. That was a hope and an expectation. And of course, if that hope and expectation was not fulfilled, many times it was accepted in silence. However, if the individual who had access to the master did in fact begin to behave in ways that not only escalated the punishment and the severity of the oppression, but became part of the systematic application of that on a regular basis, then everyone had the right to protest against that behavior and to express disappointment. Using that as a metaphor, I pointed out that in the United States of America, and around the world indeed, many parts of this world still languish from a plantation mentality, although there may not be any clear indication of people in shackles and chains and bound to ships. There was something far more insidious, and that is the bondage of the soul, the bondage of economics, the pain and the bondage and the slavery of poverty, and all the things that it does, and the role that American policy in many instances plays in the perpetuation of that poverty and that oppression. And sometimes from that perpetuation of poverty and oppression, we glean great profit for the companies that exploit regions where people are underpaid and undernourished. And we know that. And that it was a sad thing that in the 21st century, with so much technology and so many gifted men and women and so much intelligence available, that these customs should still be in practice. And that Colin Powell, as the Secretary of State, had a lot to say and a lot to do about impacting upon laws that did not serve as humanity and did not serve peoples of color, particularly in Africa. And I made that remark, but I also tell you something on that same broadcast in that same moment. I critiqued Rumsfeld, I critiqued Bush, I critiqued Ashcroft, I critiqued the entire administration and Condoleezza Rice as well for what the administration was doing. And I didn't parcel out Colin Powell for any particular, it was not a personal attack. When the young man asked me about what did I think of Colin Powell, I immediately jumped to policy and tried to talk about policy. I still feel that about Colin Powell. I think that he's a huge disappointment. I think that he is not so cleverly manipulated the system and moved his way through his responsibilities to the worst interests of the American people and certainly the peoples of color.
Have you spoken with him since you made that comment?
No, I have publicly as well as privately extended opportunities to Mr. Powell for us to sit and to have some exchange and to some conversation on this subject.
Had you known him before? Had you met him?
Yes, I've met him before. We've known each other throughout the years. I'm not an intimate of his, but certainly in the place that we've met, our exchange was always very friendly. I considered him to be a friend, and in many ways I find things in him that are still quite friendly and should be embraced. The fact that I criticize Colin Powell and the position that he's taken doesn't mean that I've given up on his soul. Dr. King, to whom I was deeply devoted and whose philosophy is something that I try to live out, the creed of, suggest that no human being should be treated as if they could not be redeemed, and that redemption was capable in all of us. And I think that Colin Powell could still do this nation a great service.
How?
By truly examining, now that he's seen the drama unfold, how much he misled the United Nations, how much he's been a part of misleading the American people, and just saying, you know, I cannot go any further with this charade.
Do you believe that he would have better served the country Had he resigned in disagreement with the administration?
I think first and foremost, it might have been understandable had he tried to use his position within the administration to change the course in which the administration was headed. That was the expectation that many of us had, when that clearly was not what was going on, but instead he appeared to be supporting and very enthusiastically constantly said, I deeply appreciate and respect and embrace my leader, meaning Bush, and everything that he says, and I welcome the opportunity to serve him as fully as I can, then he's made his position quite clear. Because that position that he's talking about is one that's fraught with the deceit. We've been given a lot of misinformation. Our press and our media has been filled with the contradictions that we've come to understand about why we were in Iraq and even what we said we were doing in Afghanistan. And it's not the first time we've ever had policy that has been deceitful. Previous presidents have been guilty of some of those acts as well. The question is, how long does the American people continue to accept it?
Isn't it also a question of having lost a policy battle with Rumsfeld, the Secretary of Defense, mm-hmm. with the President of the United States, with Paul Wolfowitz, did Secretary Powell not put up a good fight but lose? And did he not remain honorable to his president and the American people by staying in office as opposed to resigning?
I'll tell you, Diane, that I genuinely believe that given the amount of trust and faith and hope that was invested in Colin Powell by millions of Americans, not just Americans of color, but everyone looked at him as a sign of enormous hope with an administration whom they expected to be quite conservative in its policies. They had those expectations. And I think that Colin Powell could have done this nation a huge service had he lived out those expectations by not only disagreeing
publicly.
Publicly, of course, publicly. Why keep the job if the job is rooted in villainy?
So you
Where's the virtue there?
He should have resigned.
If he could not make the difference that the people had hoped he would make, or the difference we thought he was intent on making, then I think he would have done us a great service by focusing on the problem and how grievous the problem was by saying, I can no longer serve this flawed administration and any act that is as immoral as many of the acts that we're putting on the table.
What do you think the goals of this administration are?
I think that as much as what is being done is wrapped in the cloth and the flag of patriotism, I think patriotism is the least of this administration's objectives. I think there's a flaw here. I think this administration is enamored of power. I think it loves power. It sees power as an end in itself. And of course, when you have power that becomes as absolute as the presidency is able to enjoy, there's an old British saying that power corrupts and absolute power corrupts absolutely. And I think that Bush, Cheney, Rumsfeld, many who have been at the drawing board for decades on this imperial movement in our country are really looking at conquest and looking at America being an imperial state rather than America being a powerful and a promising democracy in concert and in honorable exchange with other nations, and therefore bringing equality to the table when we talk on issues and people's behavior.
What about internal issues like affirmative action, like the right to choose?
I think these rights, which have been enjoyed to the fullest by many of our citizens up until recently, are now seriously being abridged. I think affirmative action is one of the great tragedies of our current administration and the reversal of that action.
And we'll open the phones now. 1-800-433-8850. Let's go first to Cynthia in Vernon, New York. Good morning to you.
Good morning, Diane, and good morning, Mr. Harry Belafonte.
Good morning.
This is a thrill for me. I want to tell you that I was one of those young girls in 1953 who were in love with you. And now, as an old wise person of 74, I still am. But that's not why I'm calling, of course. I just want to say that you have just expressed eloquently for many of us who think the same way. And I thank you for what you have just said. And music is really the language of peace.
Cynthia, thank you so much for calling. As we talk about music, I think it's time to hear some of my favorite music that goes back to my years growing up. Let's hear the one I sing most of all.
Hey! Daylight come and me want go home. Work all night and a drink a rum.
Daylight come and me want go home.
Stack banana till the morning come.
Daylight come and me want go home.
Come Mr. Tallyman, tally me banana.
Daylight come and me want go home.
Come Mr. Tallyman, tally me banana.
Daylight come and me want go home.
Live
6 foot, 7 foot, 8 foot bunch.
Daylight come and me want go home.
6 foot, 7 foot, 8 foot bunch.
Daylight come and me want go home.
Day is a day, oh.
How old were you when you recorded this?
This was recorded in 1954, so that would have made me 27.
And that was the year I graduated from high school. We all were singing it, no question. Tell me about your voice and how it developed into what we are hearing.
Well, very quickly, I'm born with a certain vocal print. That's my DNA, that's my genetic creation, the way I was created. And it has this natural husky edge to it. However, when I sing, I engage other muscles and other elements within the vocal mechanism. I therefore produce a sound that is a little bit different from the way I speak. However, I never set out to be a singer. I set out to be an actor, which was my real interest. And when I finished my course of study, and it was a very intense one, I had to turn to singing as a second choice. And it was how to use this voice in relationship to song and to turn it into an art form that would be pleasing to the listener and to be instructive.
Daylight come and me one go
home.
Daylight come and me one go home.
A quick break. When we come back, the rest of my conversation with Harry Belafonte.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
It's news,
culture, and curiosities.
From the District, Tacoma Park,
Alexandria,
Friendship Heights,
Hyattsville,
Falls Church,
Northeast Washington, D.C., in your inbox every weekday afternoon.
DCS Daily. Sign up at dcs.com/newsletter.
dcs.com/newsletter.
Here's the rest of my conversation with Grammy, Emmy, and Tony Award winner Harry Belafonte. He joined me on the Diane Rehm Show on December 9, 2003. And for those of you who've just joined us, my guest this morning is Harry Belafonte. You know him as an artist, a musician, a human rights activist, involved in so many efforts around this world. Mr. Belafonte, this morning, former Vice President Al Gore endorsed Howard Dean as the Democratic candidate for the presidency. What's your view of the Democratic candidates? Have you made your choice yet?
No, I have not made my choice yet. I think that with all of the verbiage that has been imparted on us citizens, the Democratic Party and many of the Democratic candidates have yet to talk in a very in-depth way to the problems and to the anguish and to the fears and to the pain that our citizens are experiencing. I think the polemics have been very clearly designed to hit a certain kind of rhythm that politicians usually hit, and they sell their wares according to the style of television and sound bites and things that they feel will be assured of getting on the 6 o'clock news. But I think American society is more than a sound bite. And I think the way in which we need to hear from these candidates in a far more detailed way about how they will handle policy, how they will really take care of many of the issues that plague us, I think that it's still a lot left to be desired. I had occasion to talk with a candidate, Kucinich, last evening. And in the same environment of discussion, I pointed out that, you know, I live among the poor. That's the work that I do. I'm deeply involved in the prison system in the United States of America, working with some remarkable men, some wardens who run some of the most violent penal institutions in this country, like Sheriff Leroy Baca out in Los Angeles County Jail, or Warden Finn up in Northern California. And I watch what goes on with the prison population. As a matter of public policy, we build more prisons in the United States of America than we build churches, than we build schools, or than we build healthcare centers. And we are now turning over the prison conduct and administration to the private sector. Well, in the United States of America, in free enterprise and in capitalism, nobody takes on real estate that they don't expect to make profit from. And in order to make profit from the facility such as a prison, these prisons must be filled. And there must be men to feed and things to do from which the profit is extracted. Well, what kind of signal is being sent to the citizens, the black citizens, the youth in particular, because we have more black men and women in prison than we have in the universities of America? What's being said to the young people of America, Hispanic, black, poor, who make up the prison population that we're building more, and that we have the largest prison population in the world, larger than China or India? We have that does not sit well. What does a candidate say about that? I'm interested in hearing about Iraq. I'm interested in hearing about foreign policy. What do you do with the devastation of health care? You sit here and talk about saving Medicaid and Medicare, and you talk about finding ways in which to make prices more affordable for citizens. And we get into the detail of this kind of gerrymandering and juggling of concepts within a frame of something that doesn't work to begin with. There are two things that should be in the United States of America as a matter of right and should have long ago been part of our fabric of existence, and that is education should be completely free. Not a cost should be attributed to anybody who goes out to learn from the childhood until you get out of the university. And no health care need by any citizen in this country should cost citizens in this country anything. And if we can find $87 billion on a minute's notice to send to Baghdad and to Iraq to continue to further our mischief in that region, and to leave these kinds of issues here in America unattended, I refuse to believe that we do not have the financial and the economic resource and the wherewithal to treat our citizens to a very fair and open and a democratic healthcare and educational system.
All right, let's take a caller here in Arlington, Virginia. Good morning, Duke.
Oh, good morning, Diane. And welcome to one of my favorite singers, Harry Belafonte.
Good.
Yes, I am calling because Last night, I participated with a lot of concerned Venezuelans, where a letter was handed to Mr. Belafonte with 350 concerned Venezuelans in the Washington, D.C. area because of his tacit support for the Chavez government in Venezuela because of the screening of a documentary called The Revolution Will Not Be Televised, which has been demonstrated to be more of a propaganda film than a documentary. My comment to Mr. Belafonte and question is primarily why he's so supportive of the Chavez government, which has been so much against human rights.
All right, sir, let's hear Mr. Belafonte's response.
Well, I'd like to thank the caller for his remarks and for the question that he's put before me. I think you should not be too hasty in trying to define that my behavior and my commitment to what goes on in Venezuela is in support of a personality or an individual. What I'm dealing with here is a deep caring for the democratic process and for what's happening to the Venezuelan people. If you will examine the history of my life and my commitments to societies and issues and governments that are in struggle with trying to create and to maintain a democracy, you'll find that my behavior has a consistency to it, and very little of that behavior has to do with personalities. I don't know Mr. Chavez. I've never met him. I do know, however, that he was elected under a democratic process with a constitution that was put in, but that was put in, and a referendum that was supported and voted upon by the Venezuelan people. There's a process within that constitutional mandate, and that is that you will the individual stays in office until his term of office is ended, and then the society goes back to the polls and votes. I have too often seen American policy where nations are in their infancy as democracies become totally dismantled because the United States policy, through the CIA, through many of its lending agencies, through its support mechanisms in legislation and politics, have undermined the best interests of these nations because we didn't find their policy to be our liking. We've done that in Chile. We did that in the Dominican Republic. We did that in Grenada. We've done it in several countries in Africa with the murder of Lumumba and the destabilization that went on, both with the CIA and the KGB during the Cold War. I can go on and on and on. And so what I look at when I look at Venezuela is not so much a support for Chavez as it is a statement as an American who knows that the United States of America has a heavy hand through the CIA in what is going on in the destabilization of Venezuela, and saying, first of all, hands off, America. Let nations determine their own destiny. That is their right, and that is what we say we want to embrace other peoples to have the right to experience in this world. And that's what it is that I'm doing.
And, of course, Cuba holds a special place in your heart.
Well, I've known Cuba for a very, very long time, not only before Fidel Castro, but during the time of Batista. As a matter of fact, in my youth, it was part of one of the great joys of my career, with Frank Sinatra and Sammy Davis Jr. and with Perry Como and with Dean Martin and all of us. We went flocking off on many a weekend to the American playground in Cuba called Havana, and we sang in the nightclubs and we gambled and we had times of great luxury. While in this context, I noticed peoples of color suffering terribly. And I saw that there was a great number of people in the Cuban society that were undereducated, underserved, and that the oligarchy, the elite, were having an inordinately good time at the expense of the poor. And I became very much involved and wanted to change our policy with Cuba under those conditions. When the revolution took place and Cuba began to strike out at another horizon, in the development of its society, a lot of us began to take notice of what was going on with this experiment to try to bring a different economy, to try to bring a different set of values. And one of the earliest things that we noticed in the transformation of this new society was what was going on with education, which incidentally is free.
And everybody, the country of Cuba, as everybody knows, has one of the highest literacy rates in the world. Everybody in Cuba reads and writes. Medicine. When we saw these positive things beginning to take place, and understanding the extent to which America resisted this kind of change, I began to see policy in this country become quite punitive. If anybody remembers correctly, the first place Fidel Castro went when he became head of state of Cuba was to the United States. He didn't go to Russia. He didn't go to France. He didn't go to England. He came to America as our natural ally, as a place that he thought that if they understood what Cuba was trying to achieve, we would be the first to embrace that. But that was not the way it turned out, and we've boycotted that country now for 40 years. We've not removed Fidel Castro, but we've crucified the Cuban people, which is what I'm opposed to.
Would you totally remove those sanctions against Cuba now? Would you embrace Cuba? Would you change U.S. policy completely with the thought of helping those people in Cuba?
Absolutely. I will tell you this, that most people who think that Cuba is some dark society with soldiers in every corner with fixed bayonets and cruel workshops for children, work camps for children, is just not the case. Most of the world visits Cuba. When I go to Cuba and have been there with Gabriel Garcia Marquez, with people like they have a film festival every year that takes many of us there. When we go to Cuba, we see the British, we see the French, we see the Italians, we see an inordinate number of Canadians and hundreds of thousands of Americans which visit all throughout the year. And I believe genuinely that if we had an open policy to Cuba and we had free trade and we had people going there to involve themselves in tourism and Cubans coming to this country, we would enhance democracy in Cuba far more quickly than we've done with this policy.
Why do you think the U.S. policy is as it is?
I believe that they have a small group of dissidents, they're called small group of malcontents who live in Florida, who make up the Miami Cuban community, who came from Cuba as the rich, as the elite, who wanted to maintain the status quo, who used Fidel Castro as a motive for wanting to return to Cuba as it was in its classic form, which would mean going back to those oppressive conducts of government that kept the Cuban people in the oppression that they knew from before, and that's unacceptable.
Harry Belafonte, people want to know why, considering your extraordinary articulation, your ability to put issues into form and shape, why you have not run for political office. You have less than 40 seconds to answer that question.
I generally believe that the political process in this country should be embraced and supported. There are some of us, however, who already have a platform. And I looked at the platform that I have now, the one that's being used to talk on your show to your audience, and there's a trust that the public has in that voice and what I say. There's an integrity to it that is not blemished. Now, I don't mean that people necessarily agree with everything I say. Many people take exception, but they never challenge the honesty of where I'm coming from. As a politician, I'd had to have compromised so much and sell out to political machine, and I just said I could not corrupt my voice that way.
And we all know the voice of Harry Belafonte. He is here in Washington for TransAfrica and the Arthur Ashe Library. What a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you.
Thank you so much for having me. I've enjoyed this time with you.
And I. And thanks for listening. I'm Diane Rehm. I hope you've enjoyed this 2003 conversation with Harry Belafonte, along with the other interviews from the Diane Rehm Show archive we've shared with you this summer. And that's all for today. We'll be back with a new episode on Friday, September 3rd. In the meantime, you can find us on Facebook and Twitter, or send us an email, drpodcast@wamu.org. Our theme music is composed by Jim Brunberg and Ben Landsberg of Wonderly. The show is produced by Allison Brody. Our engineer today is Michael Kidd. Thanks for listening, all. Be well. Stay safe. Talk to you on Friday. I'm Diane Rains.